I'll call to order the March 8th meeting of Education Policy and Reform. We have a quorum. And the clerk will note the roll, please. First bill on the calendar today is House File 1587, Representative Biskins, Assessment of Student Growth in Academic Achievement Over Time Provided. We call it Value Added. Welcome to the committee, Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Madam Chair, members, I'd like to move that House File 1589 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on K-12 Finance.
And Representative Biskins, would you like to explain your bill?
Madam Chair, members, the bill before you is a department initiative. It essentially directs the Commissioner of Education to implement a value-added assessment program for the students that lays out what is meant by the assessment program, and it also appropriates, asks for a legislative appropriation of funds to implement this statutory mandate. And Madam Chair, at this time, I do believe that there are two people in the audience, Pat Olson from the department and Mr. Jim Angermeyer from the Bloomington School District, who will talk to the specifics of the bill. So if I could ask that the Chair consider entertaining their testimony at this time.
Indeed. Please come to the testifying table, both of you. Welcome to our committee. Ms. Olson, we'll begin with you. And both of you, remember to introduce yourselves for the record by giving your name, and if you'd like to identify your job, that's great, too. Thank you, Ms. Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm Patricia Olson from the Assistant Commissioner, Department of Education. I'm in charge of accountability improvement, which includes assessment and the federal consolidated programs. We're really excited about the value added, and we've come a long way, although we still have a ways to go. Value added means a lot of different things. If we ask 50 people, what do you envision value added, we probably get about 50 different answers. So we've been working with the stakeholders group to define what it is Minnesota wants. And I think we've come to the conclusion that our goal is to measure student growth from one year to the other. There are many models to do this statistically. The first one in many people's mind is the University of Tennessee model of Dr. Sanders, but there are many others, some simpler, some more complex mathematically. What we would like to do, this bill provides for a pilot next year. We would like, because right now we can't do value added because in the MARS system, we don't have the capability yet to match up students with their scores easily. So it's a real complex operation. That's part of what we need to beef up to be able to do this statewide. What we're planning on doing for the pilot is soliciting volunteers from the urban, rural, and suburban areas, as the bill describes, and running their data through several different models, comparing the outcomes, seeing if we are allowed in the future to use the value-added assessment as part of the AYP, what would it mean as far as what schools are identified? Is there a difference? Is there something that's going to be easier to explain to our public versus something that's very complex mathematically? What will be able to be defended in court should, you know, the worst happened and we'd be sued over something. We are prepared. Let me just, the handout that was given to you is a five slides that were used at our last stakeholders meeting to briefly describe the value added. If we look at the third slide, it has the purpose of the MCAs, which we state every time we talk about the new MCA series too. And part of the purpose of the MCAs is to help demonstrate growth from year to year. We know that's important, and in designing the new Series 2s of the MCAs, we have taken this into consideration, and we are going to provide the have embedded items so that we can develop a vertical scale that will be allow us to measure growth from year to year. Right now, we can't do that with the MCAs. We will be able to with the MCA2s. We started administering those in spring of 2006, so in 2007, when we have our second year, we will be able to provide growth scores, and we do plan on doing that within the reporting system. The next slide kind of is just for those who are interested in the technicalities of it. We show how we're going to do that by overlapping some items, providing the same items in, for example, grades 3, 4, and 5 to see how each grade performs on it. And with this, we'll be able to develop a vertical scale. Our questions right now that we are answering with the stakeholders are the use of the growth data. How are we going to use the information that's given to us on student growth? Who's going to use it? What is a year's worth of growth for those students who are 3 years behind? Is just 1 year's growth adequate, or do we need to set the bar higher? Do they need to perform a year and a quarter, or do we need to set a target so that by the time they're in 12th grade, they're on grade level? With the MCA2s, we will be able to provide an index score, and we will be able to, of course, subtract A from B and get a growth index for the student. We will be able to summarize the data by district and by school. And again, we need to have a statewide database. We need improvements to our system to be able to do this. I've asked Dr. Jim Engermeyer from the district of Bloomington, to come. He's part of the Minnesota Assessment Group, which is a group of test coordinators and other people interested in assessment from how many districts? Many districts in the area that meet once a month. And they spent several months working on a paper on value added, a position paper that they presented to the stakeholders. And I asked Jim to present it just to give you another viewpoint from what the public is thinking about value added.
Welcome to our committee, Dr. Engermeyer. Identify yourself, please, for the record.
Madam Chairman, I'm Dr. Jim Engermeyer, the Director of Research and Evaluation for the Bloomington Public Schools. And as Dr. Olson said, I've been involved with the Minnesota Assessment Group for actually about 15 years now. And for the past year, we've been setting this issue of value added and measuring student growth. And I think it's really important, you know, when you talk about a piece of legislation like this, to answer the question about why you would want to have this. If you think about the current system we have of accountability in our schools, we're basically measuring the achievement status of students at any one point in time. So when the third grade students in my district get tested, they get compared to the third grade students from last year, and they'll be compared to the third grade students from next year. And we try to measure some kind of improvement in our system, whether our schools and whether our curricula are making progress, based on how those children change. But the reality is that those children are changing also, and especially for smaller schools, the variation in the student population from year to year can be a huge difference in the achievement results of the scores, irrespective of the kind of changes that the school might put in place. Those of you that had a chance to see the Office of Educational Accountability's yearbook each year, they provide a lot of statistics on the performance of Minnesota schools. And one of the truths that comes out consistently in that is that schools that have high incidences of students living in poverty, or high incidences of students of mobility, students who move around from year to year, higher rates of student minority enrollment, those schools consistently score lower on our tests and other tests than students from wealthier schools and lower mobility. And so there's a real sense of unfairness in the comparisons that are made when you're trying to compare, for example, one of our higher-achieving, wealthier Bloomington schools to a school on the Red Lake Indian Reservation, for example. That just that kind of comparison is just inherently unfair. So what value added does is try to say, instead of comparing different groups of kids from each year, let's follow the progress of the same student or the same groups of students. Let's see how this school improved the performance of students from third grade to fourth grade, and then from fourth grade to fifth grade. And so value added is basically saying, given the condition of the student this year, how much did the school contribute, did the programs, the curriculum in that school contribute to the improvement the following year? Point four on the handout that I gave you stresses, however, that, point three, that in their discussions, the MAG group wanted to be clear that they did not want to replace the current accountability system with another one. We are all staunch advocates of the idea of standards. We all believe that all students should be held to high standards and all schools should be held to high standards, and that we should continue with the current NCLB requirements of trying to improve the performance of all students and try to reach that target of 100% of the students reaching proficiency. The value added allows us, however, to add an additional indicator that can show whether schools are doing a good job, even though they may not be reaching the proficiency target. If you can envision a matrix that has achievement level on one axis and growth on the other axis, you could see how you could divide that into four sections, and you could have schools that are perhaps high in achievement but low in growth, schools that are low in achievement but high in growth, and conversely schools that are low in growth and high in achievement, et cetera. So you have four quadrants there, and obviously the schools or the programs that we'd be the most concerned about would be schools that would have both low achievement level and low growth. Those students are behind their peers and falling behind more each year. Likewise, there are schools out there that are high in achievement and high in growth. I mean, those are really outstanding systems that are taking students at a high level and moving them even further. The group that seems to be unfairly targeted is schools that are low in achievement because of the circumstances that I talked about earlier, but are in fact producing outstanding growth. Their kids are growing at least as well as the students across the state and are gaining each year. But because of their initial status, they're going to continually score low on tests. They're going to continually score low on the current accountability measures. And the way the state currently gives out stars for recognizing schools, they're going to continue to have the perception, at least, that they're not doing a good job when, in fact, they probably are in terms of growth. So it's an opportunity, I think, for the state to add another indicator to what are really outstanding programs and to perhaps help students that are schools that are not outstanding to show some improvement. So we recognize that it's a new field. We recognize that there are a lot of statistical models out there, some of which might be difficult to interpret to our public, but I think as a way to add to the accountability of our school, we think it's a valuable asset.
Thank you, Dr. Engemeyer. That was very interesting. Are there questions? Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Hinkemeyer, I'm looking at number three on your vision for value-added model, and it says we're calling for a value-added assessment that would be implemented alongside the current AYP model, not replace it. And I'm on that stakeholders group too, and you know, it was my thought that we pretty much thought it should replace it, but for being fatalistic about the federal government ever granting us a variance. Wonder if you could comment on that.
Dr. Hinkemeyer.
Representative Gang, I think that, again, it was controversial in our group, and you're right, there are people in the MAG group and others that just see that there's never any way to replace the unfairness of comparing schools that have incomparable students. I think the reality, though, is that you could set up a scenario with purely a growth model where you could be identified as a successful school by having kids grow at least at the year, at the average yearly growth rate, year after year after year, and yet have students who never close the gap, never catch up to their peers. Because their students start at such a low level, they could reach the eighth grade level and have large numbers of their students below a proficiency level, even though they grew every year. Mm-hmm. And then I think you're in a situation of, do you provide additional assistance to those schools? Do the students in those schools get the opportunity for supplemental help? Are they successful if the school is identified successful? And I think our answer would be probably not, even though they have grown at an annual rate. So somehow we have to put both of those concepts together of growth, at least typical growth, representing, you know, solid performance for a school, but some programs and some assistance that can help kids close that gap so that they are reaching standards.
Representative Growling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hinkelmeyer, do you think it would be useful if you have a school that's making huge gains? You know, they're adding a lot of value to their students, you know, but yet, according to them, not reaching 100% or whatever our goal is that we're on by the year 2012, we would need to reconstitute that school. Do you think that would be good for those students to have that happen, and then perhaps they end up in another school where they aren't making that kind of gain?
Dr. Engelmeyer.
Madam Chairman. Representative Gary, personally, I would say not. I mean, I think if a school is demonstrating huge growth, as you defined it, in fact, those students would be closing the gap, and they probably wouldn't reach the end of their tenure in that school without coming at least close to proficiency. And if the school did not reach the current AYP's requirements, you would, without a value added, you would be saying the school is a failure. We need to do something dramatic. With a growth measure alongside of it, you can, I guess, temper your judgment by saying, in fact, that even though this school didn't reach one outcome, the sufficient number of students at the proficiency level, they provided a tremendous value to the educational level of the students, and I think that would temper our judgments about quality. So I think those are details that would have to be worked out in the accountability piece of this, but I think adding growth would certainly give us more information on which to make those kinds of judgments.
Manager Olson.
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Greiling. I think what we're planning right now, and from the messages that we're getting at the federal level, like you said, I don't think we'll be able to replace the current accountability system with a value-added piece. But I think if we can come up with a system that is technically sound and prove our case to the federal government, I think we might be able to include the value-added as part of either the safe harbor or the appeal system. I prefer safe harbor so that the schools don't have to do anything. So that, you know, in 2012 or 2014, we don't have these situations because the schools wouldn't be identified for improvement. There would be another piece to look at to say, okay, you're making progress. We're not going to tag you as needing improvement at the time.
Representative Greiling. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, you know, I definitely think adding, I mean, I think it's a no-brainer. We all agree, and we already have in statute from last session that value added is the way to go. So I don't think that's under contention here. But I think that if we don't continue to pound the federal government and get some changes, that we're doing students a huge disservice by not factoring this in when we have huge consequences for schools. And so I hope we will continue going along that path. And then I have a comment for Chairman Distance. I wish I could get bills that were introduced one day heard the next.
Dr. Olson, growth is occurring. I mean, growth assessments are occurring within our district. So would you just enlighten us a little bit on what those might be and how many districts might use a growth model at the district or school level right now?
Madam Chairman, I think what you're referring to are some of the...
the NALT, for example.
The NALT or the Scantron tests that are being used.
Mm-hmm.
Those particular tests are formative assessments, whereas the MCA is a summative. The purpose of the MAP, which is the computerized adaptive version, is more of a diagnostic to guide instruction at several different points during the school year, whereas the summative is kind of a one-point-in-time snapshot, which right now is what is required. The problem with using a test like the MAP for accountability is the federal government has called it illegal. They don't even say non-compliant now. They're saying illegal because it doesn't specifically measure the state's grade-specific standards. You know, it allows the student to float either up or down to different grade levels, and that is the reason that the federal government will not accept it.
Thank you. Dr. Engelmeyer, did you want to comment on that?
Madam Chairman, I think there are a lot of districts, as you say, that are using a growth model. Bloomington uses one, using the Northwest growth measures. Mm-hmm. I think the problem with it is it's fine internally within that district, but every district that uses a growth model uses a slight variation on the way they calculate growth, the kinds of measures they use, whether they include all of the students from a previous year, whether they only include matched pairs, etc. And so we each have an internal measure of growth, but nothing that we can compare across districts. And if we want to have a measure that we can lay alongside of the MCA accountability, the AYP accountability, then it's really important for all of the districts in the state, all the schools in the state, to be able to participate that in that in an equal level, and right now that doesn't exist. And the advantage of using current tests, MCA tests, for that growth measure is that students don't have to take any more tests. They are sufficiently tested now, in my opinion.
Thank you for that clarification, Dr. Engelmeyer, and thank you, Dr. Olson. Representative Bistons, please return to the microphone and give your closing comments and renew your motion, please.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. A couple of comments. Number one, I appreciate the comments that were made that this is almost a no-brainer and that we all agree that value-added assessment is, and the legislature has said already that it is a path we need to walk down. This piece of legislation begins our walk down that path, so I'd appreciate your support. To Representative Greiling's second comment, as I told my students on a yearly basis, I can be bought. All right? Just got to find the right price, but I can be bought. Madam Chair, with that, I'd like to renew my motion that House File 1587 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance.
And committee hearing that renewal of the motion, all those in favor...
Madam Chair?
Yes, I'm sorry, Representative Flatt.
Any discussion to the bill?
Yes, discussion, of course.
Thank you. First, I'd like to ask the chairman what the coin of the realm is.
Representative Bistons.
Chairman doesn't have to answer that question. Secondly, I have a suggestion just in the drafting language here for clarification of the intent of the bill. I have consulted with Ms. Larson about this, and I believe she's in agreement with the suggestion. On line 10 at the end of the line after the word reporting, I recommend that we insert the word individual. To clarify that we are seeking to assess individual students' growth. As it's currently drafted, it could be interpreted as either individual or collective students' growth. And then a similar change or addition would be made on line 12 after the word of, just before students. And then similarly on line 23 after the word on, before the word students, insert individual. I guess I'd offer that as an amendment to see if the author would accept that as a friendly amendment.
Representative Biskins.
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask that Dr. Olson return to the table to comment on that.
Welcome back, Dr. Olson, and please identify yourself again and respond to the suggestion of this amendment.
Patricia Olson from the Department of Education. I think the addition would be clarifying and as long as we can also do some aggregate analysis, but I think the individual would, in this use right here, would be a helpful addition.
Representative Biskins.
Madam Chair, I'd like to accept Representative Watt's amendment as a friendly amendment and incorporate it into the language.
Representative Schroen has
before
a comment.
Before you add that, the English teacher says that you have to move that possessive pocket to the inside.
Right. I was going to recommend that change, yes.
Just want to make sure.
Yes.
Inside the S.
Yes, absolutely. Apostrophe S, not S apostrophe. And Ms. Larson, you will make that change, and we respect that. Oh, and we need to also include on line 3 in front of student, inserting individual. So members, just so you know, in the title, it'll be assessment of line 3, individual student growth. Line 10, the insertion of individual and the correction of student to apostrophe S, so it's the singular possessive. Line 12, insert individual in front of student, correct accordingly, grammatically. And line 23, insert individual in front of students and correct the grammar. Representative Biskins, any other comments?
Madam Chair, I do believe that amendment has been incorporated.
Yes, it has. This amendment has been incorporated in a friendly way. Representative Lass.
Thank you. One other question. The Section B, or Section 1, Paragraph B, beginning at line 20, indicates that the Commissioner may issue a request for a proposal to contract with an organization. The way it's drafted leads me to question whether there is an intent to solicit just one proposal from a particular provider, or if the goal is to issue a request for proposals and then select from among any providers that may submit proposals. And if the intent is the second, then we ought to make the change in the language in the bill.
Madam Chair.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Watts, my preference would be that it be an open, competitive process. So if you have a suggestion for a friendly amendment, I'd love to consider it.
Representative Watts.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman, then I recommend that we delete, in line 20, delete the word just before the word proposal and add an S at the end of proposal so that it is plural.
Representative Biskins.
Madam Chair, I'd like to incorporate that amendment into the legislation.
And Ms. Larson, would we need to change on line 21, organization to organizations, or not?
Madam Chair, members, I believe that the contract would ultimately be an organization. I think that's the intent.
Okay. Yes, it is the intent. So Representative Biskins does incorporate that in a friendly way. Are there other questions or discussion? Representative Biskins then renews his motion that House File 1587, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to Education Finance. All those in favor signify by saying yes.
Yes.
And I'll say yes to that. All those opposed say no. The motion prevails, and this bill is re-referred to Education Finance. The second bill on our schedule for today is House File 1176, Representative Broad. And Representative Broad, I will move House File 1176 to be before this committee, recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. Welcome, Representative Broad. Nice to have you in education. Will you introduce yourself and proceed with your bill?
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm very pleased to be here bright and early this morning. I, Representative Laura Broad, I represent District 25A, which includes all of LeSueur County, portions of Sibley County, and a small, wonderful piece of Scott County. Mr. Chair, that was for you. Essentially, House File 1176 is a bill that talks about how variances are used, essentially, in the state. Currently, the Minnesota Board of Teaching is allowed under statute and rule to issue personnel variances, and currently the board has issued variances for special education licenses for a low-incidence region. What we're proposing that these variances that have been issued for one low-incidence region are allowed to be used in other low-incidence regions throughout the state. I do have with me today Gary Midas, who is the Executive Director of the North Central Service Cooperatives, who brought the idea forward, and I'd like him to talk about how this will work in Minnesota here today.
Thank you, Representative Broad. Welcome to our committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Gary Midas, and I'm the Executive Director of the North Central State Service Cooperative located in Staples, Minnesota. The law as it presently is, stands works well for school districts that are sharing special ed teachers that know about it in advance so that they can each apply for a variance for that same person. Unfortunately, the realm that we deal in, the low incidence project area, is quite different than two school districts sharing one special education teacher. What we find is that, as an example, the Long Prairie Gray Eagle School District may have a student that's deaf or hard of hearing. They ask us to employ a staff person to meet that student's needs. We'll do that during the summer and get that person issued a variance for their license. And 2 weeks into the school year, the student's family will transfer to Fergus Falls, let's say. These families seem to be more transient than even the normal situation might be. And as a result of that, we find then the new host school district being in a quandary because they don't have staff to meet the needs of that student. Oftentimes what we try to do is cooperate across regional low incidence boundaries to work with our sister agencies then to provide this same teacher for the same student. And that seems to make sense, except that the law then stands in the way and says that we need another variance for that school district, which we immediately apply for. But in this specific case, it took 42 days for that variance to be issued. And then based on that, 42 days of funding was withheld for the new host school district. This has happened dozens of times over the last several years, and we see no reason why. Once a special ed license variance has been issued for an individual, even though it's issued to a school district, it ought not be good at least for that whole year, regardless of where that teacher would teach.
Thank you, Mr. Needis. Are there questions for either Representative Broad or our testifier? Are there others who would like to testify in favor of this bill? Either those who want to testify in opposition to this bill, although we've not heard from anyone. Then I will renew my motion that House File 1176 pass and be moved to the General Register. All those in favor say yes.
Yes.
All those opposed, no. The bill is passed and moved to the General Register.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
And we have some minutes before us. Oh, is there someone asking me a question? Some minutes before us from March 3rd. Representative Seibert, have you studied the minutes, and would you move approval if you have done so, please?
Madam Chair, I have studied the minutes, and they look perfect, and I move that we approve them.
Thank you. Representative Seibert moves approval of the minutes for March 3rd. Are there any additions or corrections? He says he has studied them, so I think we'll take him at his word. All those in favor say yes.
Yes.
And all those opposed say no. The motions are adopted. Representative Viskins, do you want to give us the details of, because we're going to recess this meeting now, and I think we need to be updated on the...
Madam Chair, and Madam Chair and members, as per my email message that went out last week, we will be meeting on the east side of the state office building at 4 o'clock. That's the Martin Luther King Boulevard, at the same place where we met the bus when we went down to Winona. We'll be meeting the bus at 4 o'clock. I have heard estimates anywhere from 2 hours to up to 3 hour drive time, taking in mind that Representative Blaine can sometimes have a very heavy foot, all right, we'll probably lean closer to the 2.5 hour time slot to get to Deerwood, Minnesota. We plan on reconvening the meeting at exactly 7 o'clock in Deerwood, Minnesota. We will listen to testimony for approximately one and one half hours or less, but we will be adjourning the meeting in Deerwood, Minnesota at 8:30 or before, but no later than 8:30. Plan on returning to the state office building then at approximately 11 o'clock in the evening. You've been passed out a sheet which has different menu lists. If you would please put your name, if you are planning on going, put your name on this sheet, choose your meal, and the meal then will be served on the bus on the way up. And if you could do that and get it back to Ms. Mayo or Ms. Bowie before leaving here this morning, that'd certainly be appreciated. But the plan right now, of course, is to recess the meeting and then reconvene at 7 p.m. in the Deerwood Auditorium in Deerwood, Minnesota.
And this meal, members, will be deducted from your per diem. Representative Dorn, question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Biskins, as you know, I do have some concerns about this meeting. I certainly don't want to contribute to causing more antagonism and disruption in that area that is going through, I know, some really difficult times. But so be it, I guess. The question is, how is the list of testifiers being assembled? Is it all whoever shows up and then raises a hand and comes to the mic, or do we already have a list of people who have asked to speak? And you know, just how is that being done? And my concern is obvious with so much emotion in that district, how is it that certainly all points of view are able to be presented in what we're going to be hearing.
Representative,
and I think the public needs to know how they can get on the list. I guess that's kind of the bottom line of it. Or is the list already full for that hour and a half that we've said? Just where are we in terms of that whole issue?
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Dorn, and committee members. It was left us as an open list for people to reply to the committee administrator. I believe she has had close to 30 phone calls. Is that not correct?
Yeah.
Close to 30 phone calls from people who are interested in providing testimony. I had a comment from a government relations person yesterday who talked about a process where it would be fair for the committee to set aside time, half for one point or one side of the issue and half for the other side of the issue. If that's what this meeting was all about, that would be a very fair comment to make and a very fair process to take. But something I put out in the email to all committee members, and I'll re-emphasize here at a public forum, is that we are not going up to Deerwood, Minnesota to take sides in any way, shape, or form on the issue that's occurring and the negotiations that are underway. In fact, I'll reiterate that both sides on the issue are equally right according to the processes, rules, and laws that we here have created. Right? But that's just the point. The point is, what are the ramifications of the processes, rules, and laws that we've created? So what my hope is that this becomes an educational experience for members of the committee who may have never, ever had first-hand experience of what happens in the lives of people and a community when a school shuts down in mid-year. And I think it's important, while uncomfortable, I think it's important that we gather that experience. Is it with a specific agenda in mind? Well, much as I would tell my students in math class when they ask me, why the devil do I ever need to learn how to factor quadratic trinomials, I haven't used it outside of the classroom yet. Representative Wardlow may have in figuring out some of his taxes. I'm not sure. But there is value and there is benefit to firsthand learning. Right? And also I think there's value and benefit to allowing citizens who were here to represent the ability to at least know that the people who are elected to serve and represent them are not sitting in some white marble building in St. Paul oblivious to what's happening around us. Right. I believe that they also need to know that we are, and we do, no matter what side of the aisle we're on, care passionately about conditions and situations. It will be very important to me, right, that the committee meeting is kept very sensitive along the lines of not negotiating in public in any way, shape, or form. And Representative Dorn, I know that while I'm often compared to a bull in a china shop, you are considered, I think, by members on our aisle as being a very compassionate and thoughtful person, and I know that with your help, we'll be able to do so. So, thank you.
Are there any other questions? Representative Freiland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure. I think I'm more on the bullish side, but in any case, I'm not able to go. I have a prior commitment that I could have canceled, though, if I really thought it was a good idea to go up there, and I just don't. You know, I think that I would feel somewhat like a voyager looking at other people's misery. I have had strikes close to my own community, Mounds View School District, which is one of the districts I represent, and so I already know what this does, and I think most of us could imagine without taking a trip up there, spending a lot of hours, that is very divisive for a community, and you have neighbors and friends who never quite feel the same about each other after you've had something like a strike. And, I'm just concerned that that we, by going up there, that it's not going to help matters. You know, if at best I see it as not hindering matters, but I don't see it helping really in any way. And at worst, you know, it could be detrimental to that community. You know, they might polarize themselves by thinking they have sympathy for one side or the other. And so I just had to express my words. I also, think that if we, when we had our discussions of the January 15th deadline for negotiations, if we remember that when we saw the statistics on strikes, there's a lot more strikes when you don't have a deadline. And so I think if I were there, that would be one of the things I would be asking people about, which, those who are there may want to check into.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Vistens, I just wanted to comment. I think the problem with the question that you pose is one of time. The height of the strike bill in the legislative committee, I don't see how that can help the situation at all. I think the question you pose would be more appropriate after settlement is reached, and undoubtedly there will be a settlement at some point. So I don't see where this is going to be a helpful hearing to either side. But, Madam Chair, I did have a question, and that was when you mentioned that Representative Biskins, there was something like 30 phone calls. How were people notified of the hearing? Were there some people that you solicited testimony from? Was there a press release, or just how did it come about that you had 30 that called you, but then your committee or your staff contact specific individuals to testify? Because I have a reason for that question.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Carlson, there was a press release that went out on Friday, and that's how our committee nor the committee staff solicited nobody.
So there's no one solicited in particular to
not
forward to comment.
Representative Biskin.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, not from the committee per se. Now, there are legislators in the area, and I know that they have been contacted also by specific people, but not from the committee per se.
Madam Chair, the reason I raised that question of Senator Biskin is that there's rather strict rules under both state and the law, National Labor Relations Act and so on, in terms of what people that are involved with the collective bargaining process can say publicly. So that's another area that you have to be very sensitive to, and when you have testimony and people most directly involved can't really respond to certain kinds of questions, that creates another difficulty with having the hearing at this particular time at the height of negotiations. So I only wanted to express my concern about doing it currently.
Are there others who would like to? Representative Wardlow.
Just one question. If the intent is to gather information on the effects of their situation on the community, could we have gone to, say, Red Wing, where everything's done, and got the same information?
Representative Biskins.
Madam Chair, Representative Wardlow, and gotten the same information in hindsight, I suppose. Is that? I guess it's theoretically possible, but it is a different dynamic when a strike is actually, or when a school shutdown is actually going on. It's still a different dynamic. To respond to whether or not this helps or hurts the negotiations, again, I think to refocus, and a statement that I will make when we reconvene, is that there is very little the legislature can do for the situation that is currently going on, short of passing some emergency legislation and having a governor sign it, but there is no such thing on the table, and at least the chair of this committee is proposing no such thing. We will hear no bills while we are up there. So to further help the situation, the negotiations, the two sides, is not my focus, nor I hope the focus or intent of anyone on this committee, but just to listen to the community members, listen to the parents and the students, and business owners who are directly involved. That's the intent of the hearing, and Representative Wardlow, it's a different set of information when the incident is currently happening versus when it happened a year ago. In my mind, anyway.
Seeing no other questions, this meeting stands in recess. Thank you, Sandwich Orderson.
Hi, Jean.
Thank you for the quality.
Is she a resident?
Jean.
And why?